Minus five. That's not the way that it's done. Before that, Wilco, Can't Stand It, and Dead String Brothers with Get Up, Jake. That is just about going to do it for me this evening. This is DJ Chris Wired. I want to thank you for joining me for Breakfast for Dinner. Reminder, this show is replayed Wednesdays from 5 to 6 every week. So if you want to listen again or you miss the Sunday show, that's where you go check it out. I'm going to leave you this evening with the Baseball Project. Actually, some members of the Minus Five are part of that. Don't call them Twinkies. Have a good evening.
But I'm told they gave the MVP to Zoli over Zayas. Oliva hit the singles, and Harmon hit the homers. Marquette Grant won 20 games, so they didn't play in a dome yet. The Dodgers came to Bloomington to play for the World Series. The Twins took the first two. You can even ask Vin Scully. But Sandy Koufax proved to be a bit too much to crack. And the Twins went down in seven, but they vowed that they'd be back. From Nicola to Hennepin, from St. Paul to St. Cloud, the Minnesota Twins are making Minnesotans proud. And we don't buy our titles, so our summer's where we stay. But these are grown men.
These are grown men.
These are heroes. Please don't call them Twinkies. In the fall of 87, I was pretty much in heaven. I got my license and a girlfriend, the Twins had won a pennant. I pray more in the dome than I ever did at church. Kirby Puckett had the smile, Ken Herbick had the smirk. But first we tamed the Tigers, then we were dealt the cards. And they came to the Twin Cities to try to make sense of our part. It was loud and it was close, and it went to seven games. But the Twins took home the title, and that sweet music played. Down into the loop, from the south side of downtown. Minnesota Twins are making Minnesotans proud. So hey, let's make some noise. Come on, wave those homer hankies. These are grown men.
These are grown men.
These are heroes.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hello, everybody. Producer Pat Ford here, filling in for David Pakman on another exciting edition of The David Pakman Show. Fear not, David is going to be back on Monday. But for today, at least on this Christmas Eve edition of the show, you are all stuck with me. But that's okay, because we're going to talk about a lot of interesting stuff. We're going to talk about Build Back Better. We're going to talk about Joe Manchin. We're going to talk about Omicron and the latest COVID surge. So let's get right into the news. As we know, this week, Joe Manchin effectively killed the Build Back Better legislation in its current form. The $1.9 trillion social spending plan is not going to get passed this year, and it's not going to get passed in its current form. Manchin went on Fox News Sunday with Bret Baier, and he told him, look, I'm just not going to support this thing. So as of now, it's dead in the water. Chief among Manchin's reasons for opposing the bill were that he believed it would add to the national debt. He believed it would further accelerate the rate of inflation in the United States. And he just gave this general sentiment of, look, we're spending so much money as it is right now. We can't possibly afford to spend any more. So some of this economic fear-mongering stuff that we will often hear from the centrists and the right wing of this country, of course, depending on the circumstances. Well, Goldman Sachs ran the numbers and they found that actually not passing Build Back Better is going to cost the U.S. economy money, because the spending plan would infuse $60 billion into the gross domestic product. A team of economists at Goldman predicted that the U.S. GDP would grow 3% in the first quarter of 2022 if Build Back Better were passed, 3.5% in the second quarter, and another 3% in the third quarter of 2022. That's again, if Build Back Better was signed into law this year. Now, the estimate without the spending plan in place, because they redid the numbers, is that 2% is going to be the rate of growth for the first quarter, 3% is going to be the rate of growth for the second quarter, and 2.75% in the third quarter of 2022. And when you line up all of those numbers, you compare the percentages, you run the raw numbers, the differences add up to $60 billion in economic losses for the first three quarters of 2022. And of course, it's probably going to add up to a lot more than that, because it's only counting for the first three quarters of the year. And obviously, the impacts of Build Back Better are going to extend far beyond 2022. Now, of course, we have to include some caveats here. Like, for example, just because we're not going to get the $1.9 trillion legislation, there's a good chance that we get something done, right? I mean, maybe it'll be $500 billion, maybe it'll be a trillion, maybe it'll be $1.5 trillion. We just don't yet know what the total is going to be, and we don't know what provisions are going to get passed yet. And unfortunately, it seems to be really up to Manchin and what he wants to do. But we'll probably see some boost to the GDP numbers compared to those more conservative estimates. Second of all, you can never fully predict what the U.S. economy is going to do. Sometimes we hear estimates from financial institutions or government agencies about what we expect job numbers to be or what we expect the stock market to be at months down the line, years down the line. And it's always just a guess. I mean, you can make an educated guess, certainly, but you never know until it actually happens. You can't fully predict the U.S. economy and what it's going to do. But these estimates certainly do seem to jive with the reality of the economy and what we know about demand-side stimulus. Because if you think about it, if you go to these different provisions in the bill, one of the key provisions is extending the child tax credit of $3,000 or $3,600, depending on the age of the child, per year, per child. It works out so that if people have this extra money in their pocket, they're going to be able to spend it on things like going out to dinner or going on vacation or birthday presents or whatever the case may be. And the same can be said about the other provisions too, right? Because people can save some money on the cost of elder care or child care or healthcare costs or prescription drug costs. And so with that extra money, people can go out and participate in the economy, and it can be economically stimulative. So I understand why this conservative argument will sometimes win the day, because it just seems so intuitive, right? Like, if we just don't spend the money, that means that we're going to save the money. But it's actually quite the opposite, and that's exactly what these Goldman Sachs numbers show us. And we, of course, know that Republicans are going to make this argument. We know that they love to fearmonger about inflation and spending and the debt and the deficit. Of course, they only do that when a Democrat is in charge. They don't care so much about these things when a Republican is in the White House. We saw that last year with Donald Trump compared to Joe Biden this year. I mean, these things like inflation and spending, they were all going on under the Trump administration last year. Only now do they care about these things. But what's upsetting is that someone who is supposed to be a Democrat, Joe Manchin, he also buys into these talking points, and ultimately that's going to harm the people of West Virginia, and it's going to harm the country as a whole because it's going to cost the U.S. economy billions of dollars going into next year. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, you know him, you love him, he is not giving up on Build Back Better just because Joe Manchin is giving up on it. And in fact, Bernie is ready to bring the fight to Joe Manchin and bring it to Manchin's home state of West Virginia. I think it's easy for some of us to say, well, look, we have a 50-50 Senate right now, and shucks, what are we going to do? You have this split control, and Democrats, we're not going to get everything that we want because you have to appeal to the most conservative members of the party, like your Joe Manchins and your Kyrsten Sinemas. So ultimately, we'll get some stuff that we want, but not everything. Well, Bernie is just saying, I'm not going to take that approach. I'm going to stand in the way here, and I'm going to do so by making sure that West Virginia voters know exactly why they can't get all of these different favorable provisions, like the child tax credit and the elder and child care and universal preschool and so much more. And they can't get all that stuff because of their own senator, Democrat Joe Manchin. Bernie went on CNN's State of the Union this week with Jake Tapper, and he proposed the idea of CNN paying for a poll asking residents what they think of all the different components of Build Back Better. And then as he thought about it, he said, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to pay for the damn poll. Let's take a look at the video.
If Senator Manchin were here, he would say, my state is a state that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. What I'm doing in going after and opposing this legislation will be popular. And Manchin has said he thinks all this money is going to make inflation worse.
Let me talk about it. Joe Manchin voted for a huge increase in military spending. Manchin voted for an infrastructure bill, which added $250 billion to the deficit. The truth of the matter is that if you look at the military budget, $770 billion, times that by 10 years, it is four times higher than what the Build Back Better plan is. Now, you know, Mr. Manchin says he's representing the people of West Virginia. Okay, why don't you do a poll? It's CNN, do a poll. And you ask the people of West Virginia whether or not they want to lower the cost of prescription drugs. You ask them whether they want to expand Medicare to cover dental, hearing, and eyeglasses. You ask them whether they want to continue the $300 payment to help working parents in these very difficult times bring up their kids with dignity. Ask them if they want to deal with climate change. Mm-hmm. On all of those issues, I suspect people of West Virginia, like every other state in this country, will say, yes, do the right thing for working families.
Is there a...
And I challenge. You know, I told Manchin, by the way, I'll pay for the damn poll in West Virginia on those issues. See how the people of West Virginia feel.
I like that. So Bernie Sanders, he wrote the damn bill having to do with Medicare for All, and now he'll pay for the damn poll having to do with Build Back Better. So Bernie is really getting assertive there. And of course, Bernie is right. Now, if you asked voters in conservative, Trump-supporting West Virginia, do you support Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion social spending plan? You're probably not going to get favorable results. I doubt you'd get 50% support. Just being honest there, that's the reality. But like what Bernie points out, if you go provision by provision and you ask people, do you support lowering prescription drug prices? Do you support expanding Medicare? Do you support a child tax credit and all of these different things? Of course, people are going to say yes to all of those different things because they are indeed popular. And it doesn't matter whether you ask people in liberal California or conservative West Virginia, people are going to say that they like all of that different stuff. This is, by the way, exactly what we saw when it came to the Affordable Care Act years ago. If you polled people back then and you said, okay, do you want people, young people, to be able to stay on their parents' health care coverage until they turn 26? People would say yes. If you asked people whether or not they think that businesses with more than 50 employees should have to offer health insurance to their workers, people would say yes. And if you asked people whether or not they think that health insurance companies should be able to deny coverage to discriminate based on pre-existing conditions, people would say no. But then if you said, okay, well, do you support Obamacare? People would say, no, I don't. Perhaps not realizing that the ACA did all of those different things. So Bernie is exactly right here that a poll conducted in West Virginia on all of the different Build Back Better provisions, it would probably do really well there, but it of course depends on how you ask the questions. And this is also not the first time that Bernie has tried to pressure Joe Manchin in this way, and it's not even the first time that he's tried to do it on Build Back Better specifically. A couple of months ago, Bernie wrote an op-ed in the Charleston Gazette-Mail, which is a West Virginia-based newspaper, and he argued for the social spending bill, which back then was actually more like $3 trillion. It's a lot smaller now because Democrats caved to the most conservative members of their party, like Manchin and Sinema, and they reduced it by about $1 trillion. At the time, it was a lot bigger. And it seems like Bernie writing that op-ed really got under Joe Manchin's skin. And he said it was because, well, we have this out-of-stater telling us what we should do here in West Virginia. But I think it really truly got under Joe Manchin's skin because he knew that Bernie Sanders was right here. And this is what we got to do. This is playing hardball, and it's exactly what Bernie should be doing. Biden should be doing the exact same thing. Do some speeches in West Virginia, meet with people there, talk about how Build Back Better would materially improve their lives. Get on the phone with Joe Manchin's office. Obviously, you keep it respectful and you give Manchin the room to change his mind with some dignity, but make it clear that his job security could be put at risk if he decides not to support the legislation. Okay, one more story having to do with Joe Manchin killing the Build Back Better legislation this week. We have to talk about how the squad was actually proven right and centrist Democrats were proven wrong, at least when it comes to one important aspect of all of this. A few weeks ago, when the physical infrastructure deal was being debated, there were several members of Congress, the progressive Democrats specifically, who urged House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to couple the infrastructure deal with the multi-trillion dollar spending bill, Build Back Better. And indeed, for a few weeks, those two bills were coupled together. And the idea was that Manchin and some of these other centrist Democrats, they're sure yeses on physical infrastructure. They definitely want to see that get passed. But when it comes to the multi-trillion dollar spending plan, we just can't trust them. They seem to be changing their minds. And, you know, we just don't know if they're sure yeses. Eventually, Nancy Pelosi decided to cave to the moderates in the party, and they decided to separate the two bills. And Biden gave her the stamp of approval to do so, saying that we're going to be able to assure that Joe Manchin is going to vote yes on both pieces of legislation. So Joe Biden, he essentially gave us his word on that. But the squad, they weren't buying it. So when it came time to actually vote on the infrastructure deal in November, most of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, they decided to vote yes. That's Pramila Jayapal, Katie Porter, Ro Khanna, and a bunch of other familiar names. But the six squad members, they held firm and they voted no. That's Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib. And they voted no not because they don't want to see infrastructure get passed. That's actually quite the opposite. They definitely are in support of revamping American infrastructure, but they viewed this as the best bargaining chip that they had for making sure that both of the bills got passed, the physical infrastructure and the so-called human infrastructure. And at the time, there was this sentiment among many Democrats that was like, look, let's get infrastructure done. Biden hasn't had a significant legislative achievement in a while, maybe not since the COVID stimulus plan was passed back in March. And we also don't know if we're going to be able to, in the long term, maintain this 60-vote threshold that we need in the Senate to get this passed, because you really can't trust Republicans. Like, maybe they'll decide they don't want to support this thing anymore. The idea was, let's get it done now. We'll get this round of positive press coverage about the infrastructure deal. And then before the end of the year, we'll get Build Back Better done through budget reconciliation. And that will prompt another round of positive media coverage. And it'll be viewed as yet another accomplishment for Joe Biden and the Democrats. Obviously, that didn't play out. And the squad was right to question Manchin's willingness to go along with the rest of the party. We actually have a video now of Pramila Jayapal talking to Mehdi Hasan about everything that went on. And she maintains that she has no regrets in all of this, but I sort of doubt that. Let's take a look at the video and then we'll come back.
How do you feel about that today? Do you feel that Joe Biden let you down? And do you feel you got played by Joe Manchin?
No and no. We are, you know, for the weeks and the days going up to the vote in the House, everybody, every day, if I had counted, I would be, if I got a penny for every time somebody said to me, this is not going to happen. You all have given up everything. We got it done in the House. Now, I am in the same place in saying that we are getting grenades rolled at us all the time. We have to pick them up. We have to put the pin back in. And we have to continue to focus on the fact that this is going to be rocky. We can't hang our, you know, our commitments and our hopes on the words of one senator or two senators. We have to continue to work to get it done. And the vast majority of it is done. And so I was on the phone with Senator Schumer today, with the White House. And I believe we will still get it done. It's going to be rocky, and we just have to continue to leave no space in the commitment to getting it done. And listen, the president's word is on the line here, and I do still believe that he is going to do what he told me and what he told our caucus and what he told the country he would do. Had we not done what we had done, though—
And if he doesn't, Congresswoman?
What was that?
And if he doesn't?
No, we're going to do it. We're going to do it.
And the leverage that you had, your critics would argue, was lost when you voted for BIF. I just wonder, do you regret voting for the BIF deal now, in hindsight, given it's now months later and Joe Manchin is nowhere closer to signing off on $1.75 trillion?
No, I don't regret it, because I think our leverage was at the maximum point.
On the other side of the coin, we have one of the squad members, AOC, tweeting about this, saying, quote, "When a handful of us in the House warned this would happen if Democratic leaders gave Manchin everything he wanted, first by moving BIF, that's the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, before Build Back Better, instead of passing together, many ridiculed our position. Maybe they'll believe us next time, or maybe people will just keep calling us naive." And unfortunately, given the establishment Democrats' track record on all of this, and when it comes to them trying to listen to progressives, it'll probably be the second one of those two options there, and they'll probably just keep getting called naive. But there is a counter argument to all of this that we have to consider as well, and it is a strong one, which is that even if the entire progressive caucus held firm and they prevented the infrastructure deal from getting passed in the House, and they made sure that it was only going to happen in one piece of legislation, the two bills had to be put together, and that was it, are we sure that Joe Manchin would have actually voted for it? Like, the argument is that he would, right? Because he supports the infrastructure deal, and West Virginia desperately needs new infrastructure. But he just as easily could have done the same exact thing here. He could have said, you know, I like some pieces of this legislation. I like the infrastructure stuff, but there are members of my party who are trying to poison pill it with all of this other nonsense. And there was this opportunity to make this bill bipartisan, and the progressives are ruining that opportunity. So I just can't support this bill in any form. That also could have happened. That also is a legitimate possibility. And then progressives, at the end of the day, they look bad because they are the ones who are blamed for not allowing infrastructure to pass, when even some centrist Republicans are willing to do it, and you have the remainder of the Democratic Party in support of it. So what we know for now is that the squad was definitely right not to trust Joe Manchin, not to trust his word, because his word means nothing. But whether or not we actually would have been able to get both of these things passed by the end of the year, that remains uncertain, and to be honest, I guess we'll never truly know. It's sort of unfalsifiable in a sense, because it really just comes down to what Joe Manchin is thinking on any particular day, and that's unfortunately what we have to deal with. So that's everything having to do with Build Back Better as of now. We're going to go to a break. Back after this. Welcome back to the David Pakman Show. I'm producer Pat Ford here, filling in for David on this Christmas Eve. David is traveling right now. He's on vacation in Southern California, having a good time, and he is going to be back with us on Monday. You know, it's been a little while since we gave a COVID update on the show, and I thought that given the latest surge that we're seeing in infections, it would be good to provide you with one today. Obviously, much of this latest surge has to do with the Omicron variant, which we first heard about only a month ago, hard to believe. And since it came from South Africa, in such a short amount of time, it has been able to become the dominant strain here in the U.S., with an estimated 70 to 80% of current cases being attributed to the variant. Of course, the speculation when it comes to Omicron is that it's a lot more contagious, yes, but not nearly as severe. That less severe part, we're not totally sure about. We'll know for sure, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks or so. I'm going to talk more about that later, but let's take a look at the case chart. Looking at the case chart, back in the spring of 2020, we had what looks like a tiny wave there, which is actually deceptive because it was hard to come by tests during that time. The numbers were probably a lot more crazy than the graph shows. But of course, these are confirmed cases. We had this wave in the spring of 2020, and then we got a small wave in the summer of 2020, mainly because of places like Texas and Florida. There were places like New England at that time that were doing just fine, but there were other parts of the country not doing so well in the summer of 2020. Then by the winter of 2020 into 2021, we had this just out of control giant spike topping out at about 250,000 to 300,000 cases per day. But then as the weather warmed up, and more importantly, as people got vaccinated, because this is the time that vaccines became available, we went back to super low numbers. And many of us thought that in May, June, July of this year, that this all could be over with soon. But then we got into the late summer. There was another wave then, which calmed down by October. And now, unfortunately, we're heading back up, seeing about 150,000-ish new cases a day. And the question is, how high are we going to go? Retiring NIH Director Francis Collins is predicting that things could get as bad here as 1 million new cases a day. 1 million. And that's just based on how contagious Omicron is. Now, looking at the death numbers, we're seeing a slight uptick so far from the October Valley, getting around 1,500 deaths a day. But as we know, deaths tend to lag cases by a few weeks. So are we not seeing a major surge yet in the death numbers because Omicron isn't nearly as deadly? Or is it because just not enough time has passed yet, and because people are getting infected with it now, we could possibly see the surge in deaths in the next couple of weeks? We just don't know yet. Another key point is that even if we do find Omicron to be less deadly than previous strains, that's not going to help us all that much if we're seeing a million cases a day. Like, even if the rate is somewhat low, if we're seeing that many cases, there's still going to be thousands and thousands of people who die from this every single day. And it could be just as bad overall as the big wave that we saw in the winter of last year. So that's one important thing to consider. Now, obviously, we know that vaccination is our best way to protect against infection, but especially against severe COVID and death. And that's why some cities are joining cities like New York and Los Angeles and now requiring proof of vaccination to do indoor activities. And also, because of Omicron, we're seeing some cancellations that we arguably haven't seen since the start of the pandemic. So let me run through you a list of cancellations that we've seen over the past week or so. And I'm sure that this list is going to be added to over the coming days. Broadway shows have now closed their doors through Christmas week. The ball drop in Times Square will go on, but it's going to be scaled back with masks required for those in attendance. The World Economic Forum, scheduled for Davos, Switzerland, has been postponed until the summer. I'm sure many other conferences will follow soon. Companies shutting their doors to non-essential workers include CNN, Apple, Google, Uber, Lyft, and Ford. Universities that shut down their campuses early for the remainder of the semester included Cornell, NYU, and Princeton. And then in terms of travel, Israel, France, and the Netherlands closed their borders to more countries and added more travel restrictions. When it comes to sports, the NFL decided to move some games around. The NBA decided to postpone a few of their games. And the NHL is maybe being the most strict. They decided to put a pause on games until after Christmas. And also, they've decided to pull out of the Winter Olympics in Beijing, China, because of the surge. So we'll have to wait and see whether or not these decisions make sense. I think the sentiment is, well, you'd rather be safe than sorry. Let's see if cases reach a peak anytime soon. And if they do reach a peak, let's see where that peak exactly is. But the numbers right now, they're just not going in the right direction. And what worries us, especially now, is that we're about to see families get together for Christmas. We're about to see friends get together for New Year's celebrations. And so there's definitely a whole lot of reasons to be cautious now about Omicron and COVID in general. So to recap, the Omicron variant is now wreaking havoc throughout the U.S. and the rest of the world, and we're now seeing at least 100,000 new cases of COVID every single day here in the U.S., with estimates showing that it could get a lot worse. But there are some people suggesting that there's no reason to worry because, yes, while Omicron is quite contagious and we may see a lot of infections, it's not going to be very deadly. We're not going to see a big spike in the death numbers. And the evidence that people base that off of is the fact that we have this data out of South Africa, where the variant is believed to have originated, and it just wasn't all that deadly there. Well, there's this great piece now in NPR highlighting that what we saw in South Africa may not exactly match up with what we're going to see here in the U.S. We certainly hope that it does. We certainly hope that there's not this big spike in the death numbers, but we don't know for sure. We can't exactly bank on that. A study out of South Africa with 200,000 COVID-positive participants, about a quarter of whom had serious underlying health conditions, was underway between September and November of this year. So that's the tail end of the Delta wave, along with the beginning of the Omicron wave. Researchers found that as time went on and Omicron became dominant, there was a 30% drop in hospitalizations from this pool of people with the COVID cases. The rate of hospitalization for Omicron was quite low, it was only 58 per 1,000, which is the lowest of the four COVID waves that the country has experienced since this all started 2 years ago. Hard to believe it's been that long. Not only that, instances of patients needing oxygen or ventilation dropped and ICU stays went down to only 13% from where it was at 30%. Also, people recovered a lot quicker than in the previous waves. So there you go, right? We're going to be just fine here. Well, maybe. Let's hold our horses here, because the key variable is that the data did not take into account previous exposure to the virus, and many of these cases were reinfections, with South Africa believed to have a much higher level of immunity than we have here in the United States. Now, the vaccination rates in South Africa, they're quite a bit lower. Only about 1 in 4 South Africans had been vaccinated by the time that Omicron hit, but the vast majority of residents in South Africa had so-called natural immunity, having had a previous version of coronavirus. So between previous infections and the amount of people who are vaccinated in South Africa, there were just few people statistically left who hadn't been exposed to either the virus or the vaccine. Nearly everyone in this COVID pool that they looked at had some version of immunity. And we know that when you get COVID for a second time, or when you get it after having been vaccinated, symptoms aren't nearly as bad, the death counts aren't nearly as bad, and your recovery time is generally a lot quicker. So key to understanding this, maybe to figure out the number of people in the U.S. with no previous exposure to COVID or the vaccine, and we'll have to wait and see how this is going to affect them. As of now, about 62% of Americans have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated with the two doses, and an estimated 20% of Americans have been infected with COVID since the start of the pandemic. It's hard to believe it's only 20%. You'd think it'd be a lot higher than that number. Now, obviously, there's going to be some crossover between these two groups of people, because some people got vaccinated and then later got a breakthrough case of COVID. There's also people who got COVID early on and then later got vaccinated. So you can't just like add up the two numbers and come up with your overall immunity number. But when you actually crunch the numbers, when you do it appropriately, it turns out that 20% of Americans, that's 66 million people, have no immunity at all, and that leaves plenty of people who could potentially get a serious case, depending really on how severe Omicron is. And again, we just don't know yet. So we can be optimistic about the variant, but we have to be cautiously optimistic. And the best way to do that is to obviously observe the normal protocols, wear the mask, socially distance, get vaccinated if you're eligible, get the booster shot if you can. I just got my booster shot a couple days ago. Wasn't feeling so great yesterday, but you know, I got over the side effects in about a day or so. Do all the right things. Make sure that we don't just throw caution to the wind here, and make sure that we observe the right protocols. And hopefully Omicron doesn't turn out to be so bad, but we just don't know for sure yet. We're going to go to a break. We'll be back with much, much more on The David Pakman Show right after this. Hey everybody, producer Pat here, bringing you some holiday cheer on this Christmas Eve. Let's get back into the news story, starting with this one about the 2024 presidential race. A new poll finds that a majority of Americans don't want to see Donald Trump run for president again, but also a majority of Americans, they don't want to see Joe Biden run for president again either. The poll comes to us from Echelon Insights, and the results are that 55% of respondents don't want to see Donald Trump seek the presidency again in 2024. And that's great news, right? But also, statistically, just as many, 54% of respondents, they say that they don't want to see Joe Biden run again as well. Now, on the approval side, when you flip the question and ask, do you want Trump to run? Do you want Biden to run? There does seem to be more support for Trump running than Biden. 39% give Trump the go-ahead, whereas only 34% say the same thing about Biden. So the question is, 3 years out from the next presidential race, is this cause for concern for Democrats? I think part of this is that Americans are saying they want to see new faces. You know, if Trump runs again, this will be his third attempt. He's been nonstop in the political atmosphere ever since 2015. Biden, he's been in the Senate forever, and then he was vice president. He ran a bunch of different presidential campaigns, and then, of course, now he is the president. So, you know, it's just time to see some new people here. We're sort of sick of these guys, and we don't want to see an exact repeat of the 2020 election after all. And part of this also is the fact that they are quite up there in age, right? If Trump gets elected in 2024, he's going to be 78 by the time he's elected and 82 by the time he leaves office. And if Joe Biden gets reelected, he's going to be 82 at the start of his second term and 86 by the time that he's out of office. And we know that, of course, people now are living longer lives these days, and you can have elderly people who are capable of doing the job, but some may say 80s, that's kind of pushing it. Maybe we need some younger blood in there. But I think this really comes down to, at the end of the day, the most important factor in all of this is that the hardcore Trump people, who make up somewhere between 35 to 40%, unfortunately, of the country, they want him no matter what, right? They don't care about Ted Cruz. They don't care about Nikki Haley. You know, maybe Ron DeSantis is okay, but only as a backup option if Trump doesn't want to run. And so that's, I think, why we're seeing the numbers show that 39% of people say they do want Trump to run. Those are the hardcore Trump supporters. Whereas there's people who support Joe Biden, but they don't have the same sort of cult of personality view of him, right? Biden doesn't have this sort of appeal that Trump does among his base of supporters. Biden's approval rating right now is in the low to mid 40s, which is not great. It's also not terrible. But the number who wants to see him run again is, again, 34%, which is substantially lower than what his approval number is at. So that suggests to me that there's a good amount of people who are saying, yeah, I like what Biden's doing, but he's replaceable, right? Like, if you give us Kamala Harris, if you give us Pete Buttigieg or Elizabeth Warren or whoever else, we'll like them too, because at the end of the day, it's more about the cause than the person. And then also, in addition, you don't have to worry about the age factor. You don't have to worry about age or fitness or anything like that. So that's my takeaway. The Trump people are wrapped up in the cult of Trump, and the Biden people don't care about Biden specifically. They just want to move the causes forward. And I think there's a real question whether Biden will run again, mainly because of the age factor. I think that if he chooses not to run again, obviously there will be a primary in the Democratic field. There's a possibility that Kamala Harris, being the vice president, she gets that coronation treatment that Hillary Clinton got back in 2016. Hopefully that doesn't happen, and hopefully we get some progressive challenges in there to make it not so easy of a fight for her. But ultimately, if Biden chooses to run again, he'll get the nomination. And I think Trump is definitely running again also. I mean, he's dropping all these hints as to how he's going to launch another campaign. I know some people, like Michael Cohen, for example, he's saying, including on the show, he said, I don't think that Trump is going to run again because he's terrified of losing for a second time. He doesn't want to be seen as a two-time loser. And the excuse of voter fraud, if he does lose, isn't going to work again. But I just don't buy that. Like, first of all, I think that if Trump does run again, he's going to have a substantial chance at winning. I think he's actually going to get better odds of winning than he did in 2016 or 2020. And if he does lose, then he'll just tell his voters, yeah, it was voter fraud. And they're already primed to believe the voter fraud stuff. They'll just say, like, okay, well, they got us again, those Democrats rigging their elections. So, you know, I don't think Trump is really worried about anything there. It's sort of a heads I win, tails you lose sort of scenario, where either he wins the presidency or he just says once again that he got cheated. So the bottom line is, most Americans don't want to see Trump run again. Most Americans don't want to see Biden run again. And yet there's still a halfway decent shot that we see yet another Trump-Biden matchup, a repeat of the last election cycle in 2024. You know, ever since we started hearing about the labor shortage situation here in the U.S., there's been so much blame to go around. Some people like to blame lazy millennials. Other people like to blame the Joe Biden administration. Other people like to blame poor people who are just unwilling to go get a job. And, you know, there's been this idea that because of the boosted unemployment benefits, that meant that many people were just unwilling to get a job. They wanted to just stay home and live off of government resources. The same was said about the stimulus checks, with the idea that, okay, well, if you get $1,000 here and there, you don't really need to work, which is kind of silly, really, because obviously $1,000 or $1,200, $1,400, that's not going to be enough to cover your long-term basic needs. And indeed, the labor shortage does persist. The number of job openings was at an all-time high as of October at more than 11 million openings, and companies are struggling still to hire enough workers to meet the demand. But the truth is that the labor shortage is caused by a multitude of factors, and chief among them have to do with baby boomers retiring early and a reduction in worker visas that have been granted over the course of the pandemic. Overall, I was able to come up with 8 reasons in total for the labor shortage situation, so I wanted to run through them all with you here. So number one, and these are in no particular order, people are retiring early. Estimates suggest that the U.S. has about 2 million more retirees right now than we otherwise would have expected if we had not had the pandemic. And this makes sense because let's say you were 62 years old when the pandemic started and you planned on retiring at age 65. Well, by now you're about 63 and a half, going on 64. Do you really want to go back to work for another year or so, especially when you already are semi-retired as it is? Probably not, especially given the fact that the stock market has boomed over the past couple of years, so people's retirement accounts are higher than they expected them to be. Also, real estate values have gone up significantly, so people, assuming they own their house and assuming they have a 401k or an IRA, they've seen a sizable growth in their wealth over the past couple of years, making it so they may not have to keep working. They might as well just retire early. Number two has to do with immigration. The U.S. government has issued about 1.2 million fewer visas to adult immigrants, refugees, and temporary foreign workers. And I think this is intuitive given that restrictions on travel were in existence, especially during the early phase of the pandemic. Many of these restrictions still exist today. There's a chance also that things can turn around because now the Department of Homeland Security has announced that the Biden administration is going to be adding 20,000 new slots to a seasonal guest worker program for the winter season. But it makes sense that given there's a pandemic raging throughout the world, people just don't want to be traveling from country to country. Number three, there's a skills mismatch. 48% of workers said that they were frustrated with the search, and 46% said that they can only find low-paying roles. Just because a job is available, that doesn't mean that people necessarily want to take that job. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good paying job. And we know that some people were able to take advantage of their time off during the pandemic, and many people learned new skills. They did online classes, etc. And so their market value has improved. But if they don't find a job that matches their skill improvement, maybe they're just going to decide to hold out. Number four, commuting. People many times just don't want to go back to commuting. Obviously, during the beginning phase of the pandemic, many workers moved out of the areas that would be hiring by now. Like they moved from cities to rural areas and they just have decided they don't want to commute anymore. That's been my experience. Like I like working from home. It wouldn't be a total deal breaker for me if I had to start going back into an office every day, but I'd prefer to just keep working from home. Obviously, commuting can be very, very stressful, especially if you have a long commute. Like if you're driving an hour to and from work every day, I mean, that's just crazy. And if you don't have to do it anymore, why would you want to? So commuting obviously is a big factor. Number five, childcare. Most schools are open at this point, but there can be cancellations based on COVID cases at the drop of a hat. Maybe the school year gets halted early. Obviously, we're seeing some closures now with Omicron. So sometimes parents who may be working part-time while the kids are at school, they can't do that anymore because they have to be home to take care of the child, or at least they have to keep that as an option in case school does get shut down. Number six is protests over vaccine mandates. There are some people who are just not going to get the vaccine no matter what. It doesn't matter if you offer them a carrot or a stick. And so obviously, if they refuse to get the vaccine, there are so many jobs that they're no longer eligible for. They can't work for a government agency, or they can't be a government contractor. They can't work for a company with more than 50 employees. They can't work in certain cities in the country. So obviously that lowers their possibilities when it comes to the job market. And that's also contributing in part to the labor shortage. Number seven, fear of the virus. Cases are obviously surging out of control right now. The Omicron variant is super contagious. And so there are people who are maybe older or immunosuppressed, and they feel as though, you know, I want to get a job, but I don't want to put my life at risk by doing so. And number eight, the Great Resignation. This is a term coined by organizational psychologist Anthony Klotz, who theorizes that people, especially pre-pandemic, they would tie in their identity with their work. And now with people taking some time off and really being confronted with their mortality because the amount of people who have died over the past couple of years, it's caused a shift in their perspective and they no longer wrap up their identity with what they do as a job. And I think that, you know, maybe the Great Resignation talking point is a little bit overblown because after all, people need to work to survive. Most people do anyway. But, you know, there could be some people who decide I'm not going to work 40 to 50 hours a week anymore. I'm going to work part time, or maybe I'll take a few more years off and resume working later. Maybe I want to decide that I'm going to do something else with my life. So it's definitely a mix of factors. Some of these things you're going to be able to improve over time. Other things you may not be able to, like, for example, the baby boomers retiring early. Are you really going to be able to bring them back into the job market? Probably not. They're probably retired and not going to be entering the job force again, at least not in masse. But then there's other factors that will improve as the state of coronavirus in this country improves, as we finally see cases go down, we finally start to see deaths go down. Whenever that may be, the economy will follow. We've been saying this for 2 years now, that you have to deal with the virus before you can deal with the economy. And we'll hope that this all sort of sorts itself out. But that's the sort of update now, having to do with the labor shortage and many of the reasons why it's happening. Welcome back to the show. So former Trump strategist Steve Bannon, when he's not fighting off criminal charges for a build the wall money laundering scheme, or fighting off charges for contempt of Congress having to do with the January 6th Capitol riots, he hosts a TV and radio show on Real America's Voice called The War Room, wherein he tries to build up an audience of Trump supporters. And his thing is to really appeal to the gung-ho ones, the ones who believe that Trump is the savior and Trump really won the 2020 election, but if he was, of course, robbed by Joe Biden and the Democrats and voter fraud and all of this nonsense. Now, I think that Steve Bannon is an obvious grifter. He pretends to be one of these anti-establishment, anti-elitist folks, when at the same time he has degrees from Georgetown and Harvard, and he used to work at Goldman Sachs and in Hollywood. But his thing is to scam diehard Trump supporters into thinking that he's one of them, right? He's a true working-class American kind of guy. And sometimes he quite literally scams people, if you look at that money laundering scheme that he allegedly did. Well, Bannon is always trying to build up some media attention, always trying to make a headline and some recognition for himself. And he's done it yet again, this time by supporting Fox host Jesse Waters in his time of need. Now, Waters, as we talked about on the show this week, he went to a TPUSA conference called America Fest, and Waters used this strong rhetoric against Dr. Anthony Fauci, implying, without directly saying, that people should hunt down Fauci and kill him. Waters said stuff like, boom, he is dead, ambush, and kill shot. Now, Waters was speaking metaphorically, of course, but it's clear what he was doing, and it's incredibly irresponsible given the fact that Fauci and his family have received a tremendous amount of death threats over the past couple of years, mainly from Trump supporters, and he's obviously worried for his safety. He's worried about some crazy Trump supporter attacking him, so Waters' words definitely add some fuel to the fire there. And Fauci followed up by saying that Fox should fire Jesse Waters for his comments, but of course, Fox News is not going to do that. They're going to stick by their guy. Farron talked about this story earlier this week if you want to check that clip out. But now Steve Bannon is getting in on the fun. He is piling on, and he can see that Jesse Waters got some attention from all of this, and now Bannon wants to share in some of that spotlight. I'd imagine that Bannon no longer wants to be relegated to the likes of Real America's Voice, and he wants to be now a Fox News host, or he wants some sort of primetime radio job or something like that. So let's take a look at what Steve Bannon had to say, his perspective on this controversy, and then we'll follow up on the other end.
Look at Jesse Waters. Great Jesse Waters sitting up there telling exactly what you're doing. Fauci misdirects. I've only told everybody, it's about you funding the Chinese Communist Party PLA lab, you liar. You're going to be held accountable, and your buddy, your partner, Collins, with it. Collins can run away. He's leaving. We're getting him, and we're getting you. You're going to be held accountable and responsible for what you've done, Tony. Short commercial break. We'll be back with Darren Beatty, Ben Harnwell.
So he says that Jesse Waters is a great guy, and he says that we're getting you, having to do with Anthony Fauci, all of this aggressive stuff with the religious Christmas music going on in the background. That really was quite the contrast there, I have to say. And obviously, these threats don't amount to what you would need for criminal charges or anything like that, nor should they. This definitely falls under free speech because they are veiled threats after all. But you always have to be on the lookout for a stochastic terrorism event. There is a real possibility that someone in Waters' audience or Bannon's audience, they could hear these words, the ambush comment, kill shot, we're getting you, etc., and decide that these are calls to action, and they could decide to take action into their own hands and carry out something really egregious against Anthony Fauci over them. And we've seen it happen before with different people. We've seen it with members of Glenn Beck's audience. We've seen it with Bill O'Reilly's audience. If you have an audience of thousands of people or millions of people, and they watch you every day and they believe what you say, there's a chance that maybe just one person can really take those words to heart, and maybe they're not the most mentally stable, and they decide that they're going to view it as a call to action, and they could go out and kill someone because of the words that you said there. And so you have a responsibility to your audience and society more broadly not to be doing that stuff and not to be speaking so recklessly. And just a final point, because Bannon is now making a career off of sucking up to Donald Trump, acting like this big pro-Trump guy, and you know, trying to appeal to his supporters. Did everyone forget that Donald Trump turned on this guy a while ago? Like, not only did Trump fire Steve Bannon after the Charlottesville incident for being toxic, he also released the following statement about him after it came out that Michael Wolff used Steve Bannon as a source for the book Fire and Fury. Quote, "Michael Wolff is a total loser who made up stories in order to sell this really boring and untruthful book. He used sloppy Steve Bannon, who cried when he got fired and begged for his job. Now sloppy Steve has been dumped like a dog by almost everyone. Too bad." So this is Steve Bannon's life now, I guess. He has to make a living off of sucking up to Trump, who fired him and publicly ridiculed him. He has to try to appeal to the lowest common denominator of Trump supporters and reassure them all of their worldview. It's pathetic stuff, but that's exactly who Steve Bannon is. Over the years, we've seen plenty of right-wing politicians sully whatever credibility they had left, trying to get into the good graces of Donald Trump, and oftentimes it ends up just completely backfiring or they get into trouble over it. And the next person to be following this trend appears to be Trump's fourth and final White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, and that is because Meadows is no longer cooperating with the January 6th Congressional Committee, meaning that if his obstinance continues, charges could indeed be coming his way. Now, as recently as a few weeks ago, Meadows was cooperating with the January 6th committee. He was providing them with documents and really naming names, like the whole reason we know about the story having to do with Sean Hannity and Brian Kilmeade and Laura Ingraham urging Meadows to tell Trump to end the insurrection was because Meadows was willing to hand over the documents. He was willing to hand over those text messages to the committee. Obviously, we also found out that Don Jr. was trying to urge Meadows to put an end to it. And we also found out that Congressman Jim Jordan was giving an outline to Meadows as to how Mike Pence could throw out the Electoral College votes in states that they were contesting. So this is all based on the fact that Meadows was complying with the committee's requests and handing over the documents. But everything changed around the time Meadows released his book, The Chief's Chief, and Trump publicly lambasted Meadows for the claim specifically that Trump exposed people to COVID after he tested positive for the virus, and one of those people that he exposed was actually Joe Biden during their first debate. Trump called the allegation fake news, and Meadows backtracked, saying, oh yeah, that part of my book, that was fake news, apparently regretting that he upset his former boss. Meadows thought that the book was going to flatter Trump, and instead it mainly just got under his skin because of the media coverage having to do with that positive test. It did the exact opposite of what he was trying to do. It was right after this incident that Meadows halted his communications with the January 6th committee. The January 6th commission wanted to get Meadows to show up in person for testimony. Meadows' lawyer, George Terwilliger, argued he had done enough. He had provided the documents, and the committee should be satisfied with that. In fact, Terwilliger released a statement that reads, quote, "The Select Committee's true intentions in dealing with Mr. Meadows have been revealed when it accuses him of contempt, citing the very documents his cooperation has produced." So what Mark Meadows' attorney is saying here is that basically you should be grateful to my client, because so much of this information that you have now is because he was willing to cooperate with the investigation. You shouldn't be turning around now and trying to rope him into testifying if he doesn't want to. You shouldn't be threatening him with criminal charges because, you know, he's given you so much already. And it is true that Mark Meadows was fully cooperating and handed over 9,000 pages of documents, even though some of that information was indeed damaging to Meadows and to the former president. He still did do that. But you don't really get partial credit when you're talking about a select committee that has the rule of law behind them. And if you're not going to do everything that they ask of you, then you're going to open yourself up to criminal exposure. And that's exactly what's happened here. Recently, the House voted to refer Mark Meadows for criminal contempt of Congress charges. And it's going to be up to Biden's Justice Department and Attorney General Merrick Garland to decide whether or not he's actually going to be charged. And if he is, and he's found guilty, there's actually the possibility on the table of Mark Meadows serving prison time over this. Now, is that actually going to happen? I don't know. He may not even get charged in the first place because it's going to be seen as an overtly political act if this happens. Like, yes, Bannon was charged in this investigation, but he also wasn't willing to comply at all. and Bannon was in Trump's administration, but only as an advisor, whereas Mark Meadows, like, he was the chief of staff. After all, it's a much more important gig. And so maybe they would just figure that Biden and Biden's Justice Department wouldn't have the political capital to charge Mark Meadows for his obstinance in this case. But we'll have to wait and see. And then obviously, if he does get charged, that doesn't mean necessarily he'll get convicted. And if he does get convicted, that doesn't mean necessarily that he'll go to prison over it. He may just face a fine or something like that. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But you never know. Like, this could definitely happen. And there's definitely some legal exposure here, and Meadows, I'm sure, is probably not sleeping very well at night these days, and that's all because of Donald Trump, and he was trying to get on Trump's good side, and now, at the end of the day, he's not only on Trump's bad side, he's also running the risk of criminal charges. So that's Mark Meadows for you, and now there's this very, very long list of people who went down for Donald Trump's sake. You already thought it was long enough. Well, it's getting even longer. We have people on there like Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, Rick Gates, George Papadopoulos, Michael Cohen. We know that Rudy Giuliani, of course, is in trouble. He's under investigation, and he's also facing that civil suit with Dominion Voting Systems. There's people like Mike Lindell and Sidney Powell who are also running against that case with Dominion Voting Systems. So is Mark Meadows the next to follow, the next to get in trouble, trying to get into the good graces of Donald Trump? We'll just have to wait and see. But you'd think that all these people would learn their lesson by now. On the bonus show today, we have some great stories. We're going to talk about how Kim Potter, the former police officer, she has been found guilty in manslaughter charges having to do with the killing of Dante Wright. Kim Potter, of course, was the officer who confused her service weapon with her taser, and she thought that she was tasing Dante Wright, but she actually shot and killed him. She has been found guilty now, so we'll see what happens with sentencing. We'll see the reactions to all of that. We're going to talk about Donald Trump declaring victory on the war on Christmas. He talked to Mike Huckabee about how before Trump was president, no one would say Merry Christmas, and you weren't allowed to, but ever since Trump served in office, now all of a sudden you can say Merry Christmas. And I also want to talk about a recent COVID scare that I had. I think many of you will find that story interesting. If you want to watch the bonus show today, go to joinpacman.com and sign up for a membership, or you can go to patreon.com/DavidPacmanShow and sign up for a $5 membership there. That's going to do it for today. That's going to do it for the week. Merry Christmas to everyone. David will be back next week.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem. One that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
People marched and demonstrated, and apartheid ended. And democracy and freedom were born.
South African anti-apartheid leader Archbishop Desmond Tutu has died at the age of 90. Today, we'll hear the Nobel Peace Prize winner in his own words on fighting apartheid to opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
We said then, and we keep saying so, not just that it was illegal, it was immoral.
We'll re-air two Democracy Now! Interviews with Archbishop Tutu and hear two speeches, one at the massive anti-war rally in New York in 2003 and another outside the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009.
And for those who think that the rich are going to escape... sing together. Amen. We have one world.
Today, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in his own words, on war, apartheid, Palestine, Guantanamo, climate change, and more. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coronavirus cases are skyrocketing in the United States and in many parts of the world, with the fast-spreading Omicron variant combining with lax public health measures and holiday gatherings to drive daily infections to pandemic-level highs. Here in the U.S., more than 200,000 people are testing positive for coronavirus each day, nearly reaching last winter's peak, with the U.S. on pace to surpass 1 million daily infections in January. U.S. airlines canceled thousands of flights over the Christmas holiday, citing increasing rates of illness among flight crews. Meanwhile, many school districts and colleges have announced a return to online classes. Public health officials warn of a surge in pediatric COVID-19 cases, with Northeastern hospitals seeing a four-fold increase in the number of children hospitalized in the past 2 weeks. In China, some 13 million residents of the city of Xi'an have been ordered to remain at home after officials reported more than 200 coronavirus infections, the most China has reported since March 2020. The strict lockdown comes just weeks before Beijing is set to host the Winter Olympics. At the Vatican, Pope Francis used his Christmas address to advocate for universal health care and access to vaccines.
Dio con noi.
Grant health to the infirm and inspire all men and women of goodwill to seek the best ways possible to overcome the current health crisis and its effects. Open hearts to ensure that necessary medical care, and vaccines in particular, are provided to those people who need them most.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the South African anti-apartheid icon who championed human rights struggles around the globe, died on Sunday at the age of 90. In 1984, Desmond